Sharif Maruf. That does it for this edition of The Debate. For Mikhail Vitak, my entire team in the capital of Tehran, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلغوا
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories. Taiwan says it has strengthened deployments in the disputed South China Sea to confront, quote, Beijing's expansionism in the region. The British government's plan to expand its nuke stockpile draws widespread criticism from anti-nuclear campaigners. Also ahead this hour, protesters gather near the French Senate to voice their anger at a controversial security bill that restricts the filming and publishing of images of police brutality. Welcome. Taiwan says it has strengthened deployments in the disputed South China Sea amid tensions with China. Defense Minister Chiu Ku Cheng says he has sent more personnel and weapons to the Ituaba Island, that is the main island Taiwan controls in the South China Sea. The minister says his measure aims to confront what he calls China's expansionism in the region. He has also warned that those troops are capable of starting a war. China has built man-made islands in the South China Sea and air bases on some of them. That is opposed by Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, and Brunei. They also have claims on the strategic waterway. Let's try and give you some insight on what is going on in that part of the world through the help of our man, Stephen Ribe, who's standing by for us and coming to you via Skype out of the Chinese capital. Stephen, tell us more about this.
The defense minister made two points in his speech. I think actually one of them was a little bit of a non-issue, a red herring, you might say. And that's the island that Taiwan occupies in the Spratly Archipelago, Ituaba. It's the largest natural island in that archipelago. Although, of course, China has built some islands up so that artificially they have become bigger. They are now fortress islands that China has on which China has deployed military hardware. Anyway, how does China see this Ituaba Island? Well, it's perfectly okay with Taiwan occupying it because it says, yep, Taiwan is part of China, so no problem there. If it belongs to Taiwan, then it also belongs to China. I couldn't see, for example, China seizing that island. It would give it no advantage in a subsequent invasion of Taiwan. It's not like a forward base or anything from which China could launch more effective attacks on Taiwan. And the defense minister, although he said he would be bolstering military supplies to that island, He didn't talk about a permanent garrison of Taiwan's army. I think the Taiwanese Coast Guard is garrisoned there now. So I think that's something of a non-issue. What's more important in what he was saying was that America has agreed to supply the submarine fleet that Taiwan announced it would build last year. It is generally acknowledged that China is somewhat deficient in anti-submarine warfare, so that if China were to launch an invasion of Taiwan using its navy, then the most effective weapons against China's navy would be anti-ship missiles launched from Taiwan, which could be deadly, and also submarines launching torpedoes against Chinese ships. So the fact is, America, for example, has sold Taiwan $13 billion of arms over the past 4 years, and this newly announced supplies or equipment for Taiwanese submarines, which could make them deadly against an invading Chinese armada, that's very significant. I think a lot more significant than his announcement that he would bolster the defense of this, I think, somewhat inconsequential island which Taiwan occupies in the Spratly Archipelago. Having said all that, American analysts don't think an attempt by China to invade Taiwan is coming soon, although China has been stepping up its maneuvers, its Air Force flights, ship maneuvers around Taiwan and in the Taiwan Strait recently. Nobody thinks a Chinese attack on Taiwan is coming soon. But having said that, recent events in Hong Kong are actually quite relevant here. Recently, like last week, China made a reform of Hong Kong's parliament, its legislative council, its election committee, which will now appoint legislators to the legislative council, as well as voting for the chief executive. Basically, it's made it impossible for anybody who's against the Communist Party to become a legislator or have any power in Hong Kong. I think that everybody agrees that the one country, two systems now that Britain negotiated with China for the return of Hong Kong, that's dead. China has killed that. And the point is that China formulated that system with the intent of persuading Taiwan that if it renewed with, or if it reunified with China, it would retain its autonomy. So I don't think, because the one country, two systems that applies to Hong Kong is now completely dead, I don't think there's anybody, not one person in Taiwan, who believes that Taiwan would have any kind of autonomy were it to be renewed with or reunified with China now. So although a Chinese attack on Taiwan is, nobody can see it coming, because this one country, two systems that gives Hong Kong autonomy is now well and truly dead, the idea of any peaceful reunification of Taiwan with China is a lot further off now. So you could say that that implies that a military attack, although nobody can see it coming, it is more likely. So that's my analysis of this this current situation.
Thank you very much. That's our man in Beijing, Stephen Rive, updating us. Residents in a township in Myanmar's Yangon city have attended a candlelit vigil despite a curfew and a deadly crackdown by the military. Hundreds gathered in insane to pay tribute to those killed in anti-coup protests. The UN says nearly 150 people have been killed since the protests began early last month. It says more than 2,000 people have also been arrested in the military's crackdown. Myanmar's military ousted civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi over allegations of voter fraud in November's elections. Since then, the country has been in uproar with mass protests calling for a return to civilian rule. The generals, however, have intensified their crackdown despite international calls to stop it. Campaigners slammed the UK government's plan to increase the country's nuclear weapons stockpile by 40%, saying the move amounts to a violation of international law.
This will put Britain in violation of its non-proliferation treaty, NPT, Article 6 obligations.
A decision by the United Kingdom to increase its stockpile of weapons of mass destruction in the middle of a pandemic is irresponsible, dangerous, and violates international law. While the British people are struggling to cope with the pandemic, an economic crisis, violence against women, and racism, the government chooses to increase insecurity and threats in the world.
A decision to increase Britain's nuclear arsenal absolutely goes against our legal obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Britain must not be responsible for pushing the world towards nuclear war. This is a dangerous and irresponsible move and must be reversed.
The planned increase also drew criticism from Labour leader Keir Starmer, who accused the Tory government of having a worldwide reputation for breaking international law. Scottish National Party defence spokesperson Stuart MacDonald also slammed the increase as nothing short of abhorrent. The government's integrated defence review on Tuesday said the UK would be increasing the size of its nuclear arsenal to 260 warheads. The review noted that Britain reserves the right to withdraw assurances that it will not use nuclear weapons against a non-nuclear armed state. Iran's foreign minister has lashed out at British Prime Minister Boris Johnson after he accused the Islamic Republic of trying to acquire a nuclear weapon.
In utter hypocrisy, Boris Johnson is concerned about Iran developing a viable nuclear weapon. On the very same day, he announces his country will increase its stockpile of nukes. Unlike the UK and allies, Iran believes nukes and all WMDs are barbaric and must be eradicated.
The UK Premier leveled the allegation against the Islamic Republic in the House of Commons, while simultaneously defending his government's plan to increase Britain's stockpile of nuclear weapons. Iran has time and again rejected as baseless the West's claims that it is seeking a nuclear weapon. Such allegations also run counter to numerous reports by the International Atomic Energy Agency showing peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program. The IAEA has carried out intense inspections of Iran's nuclear sites over the past several years. British protesters have taken to the streets of London for the fourth consecutive night to denounce violence against women and police brutality in the wake of the murder of Sarah Everard. Protesters gathered outside the British Parliament and the London Police headquarters. They held signs reading, quote-unquote, "Kill the Bill," in reference to a motion that critics say would give police too much power to restrict peaceful protests. The bill would allow police to impose a start and end time for demonstrations, set a noise limit, and shut down protests. The motion is being debated just days after police were criticized for using excessive force during a vigil for Everard, who was kidnapped and killed by an officer. A London police officer has been charged, mind you, with killing the woman who had disappeared on March the 3rd. In France, Parisians have rallied in the capital to protest against the security bill that outlaws the dissemination of photos and videos of police officers. The security bill demonstrated in front of the Senate with a controversial draft law designed to protect law enforcement officers during operations was being debated. They said the move will hamper the work of journalists, violate freedom of expression, and restrict publicizing police brutality. The bill, which was passed by the National Assembly in November of 2020, intends to criminalize the display and distribution of images of police officers which are deemed harmful to the force. Well, on Tuesday, Catalonia's pro-independence lawmakers filed an amnesty bill for the region's jailed leaders in the Spanish Congress in an attempt to end the political crisis. Spain's ruling socialists have rejected the proposal out of hand. Here's a report.
An amnesty bill for Catalonia's jailed leaders was put before Spain's Congress of Deputies on Tuesday to end the political crisis in the northeastern region. The bill was filed by lawmakers from the four Catalan pro-independence parties with the support of Òmnium Cultural, a grassroots organization whose leader was found guilty of sedition in the 2017 referendum trial and sentenced to 9 years in jail.
We brought forward the amnesty law as a starting point for a democratic solution. If the government really believes that the repression exerted in Catalonia was a mistake, it should adopt the amnesty law as a way to correct that mistake.
Spain's ruling Socialist Party had dismissed the amnesty bill even before it reached Congress.
We have always expressed opposition against amnesty. We're always willing to accept particular cases and in accordance with the legal framework. But we have never opted for such an amnesty that undoubtedly has much more political character of acquittal.
The socialists say they favor other solutions to amnesty, namely a presidential pardon or a reform of the sedition law that sentenced the jailed Catalan leaders to up to 13 years behind bars. For the separatists, neither of these proposals addresses the hundreds of independence-related legal cases they claim are pending trial in Spain's courts.
With the amnesty bill doomed to fail from the outset, the fate of jailed leaders now goes down the path of either clemency or the reform of Spain's criminal code. A slow and winding path that even the most optimistic in Catalonia say it will lead nowhere. Cusay Kedri, Barcelona.
58 people have been killed in what the Niger's government has called barbarous attacks near the country's border with Mali. A number of vehicles were burned or seized in the attacks. The raids took place in the Tillaberi region, that's a flashpoint area, where the frontiers of Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali converge. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the attacks. The government announced 3 days of national mourning from Wednesday. Niger officials also called for greater vigilance from the population and reaffirmed their determination to pursue the fight against criminality in all its forms. Violent insurgency in the region has left hundreds of people dead and led to the displacement of many more. The second annual Tehran Dialogue Forum has been held in the Iranian capital, with participants exchanging views virtually on regional developments. During his address, the Iranian foreign minister highlighted intervention by outside powers, especially the U.S., in West Asia. He called them as the root cause of wars and conflicts in the region.
The fundamental question, though, is...
Iran's foreign minister says interventions by outside powers, especially by the U.S., are the main cause of instability in the West Asia region. Mohammad Javad Zarif made the comment during the second Tehran Dialogue Forum. During his address, Zarif also talked about the reshaping of the region, but noted that such a move requires the identification of principal causes of the problems.
The U.S. has exacerbated the insecurity and instability of this region more than any other region. As its own figures suggest, some $7 trillion have been wasted on forever wars and military interventions in this region.
The top Iranian diplomat underlined that the U.S. interventions are aimed at dominating the region. He said the region has turned into a military zone for the U.S. and its allies through their troop presence and arms sales to certain states. Addressing the Tehran Dialogue Forum, Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad highlighted the U.S. occupation of his country. He said that Washington formed a coalition under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but its main agenda was to attack Syria and threaten other regional countries.
The United States and the European Union, or the leading countries in the European Union, are using this coalition to attack Syria, to threaten other independent countries in the region, and to claim that they are fighting against Daesh. Daesh, in fact, has been encouraged and supported by the United States.
Years of devastation in Syria caused by the U.S. and its allies with their backing to terror groups are just the tip of the iceberg. U.S. interventionist agenda in other countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen and Libya all show that Washington wants to destabilize West Asia to dominate it. However, such stance has simply ignited anti-U.S. sentiment across many countries. In Iraq, protests against the presence of American troops and a parliamentary resolution for the expulsion of all U.S. troops last year are part of the sentiment.
calls grew louder after the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in a drone attack in January last year. The U.S. too has come to a conclusion that its West Asia policies have been a complete failure. Last week, the U.S. government, for the first time, acknowledged that the Yemen war has no military solution. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also told U.N. Special Envoy for Yemen, Martin Griffiths, that diplomatic efforts should be redoubled with the help of the U.N. and other players to end the Yemen war. But shouldn't Washington be blamed for the Yemen carnage, as it's been the main supplier of arms to Saudi Arabia and its allies that invaded the impoverished nation? But the U.S. views the West Asia region as a military zone, and what matters to Washington most is making profit out of chaos and conflicts, for it can sell more weapons to the rich Arab states.
That's it for me for this hour.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The limelight.
The Israeli regime can do whatever it wants with the U.S. backing, but when Palestinians protest precisely because the U.S. will not do nothing to defend them, then they are at fault, says James Zogby Ryder in an article published under the heading U.S. Policy Ignores Palestinian Human Rights. Stay tuned for more. Over the years, the approach of most American policymakers toward the Israeli regime-Palestinian conflict has been Israeli regime-centric with near total disregard for the suffering endured by the Palestinian people. The architects of policy in successive U.S. administrations have discussed the conflict as if the fate of only one party, that is the Zionist regime, really mattered. Israelis were treated as full human beings with hopes and fears, while Palestinians were reduced to a problem that needed to be solved so that Israelis could live in peace and security. It is not just that Israelis and Palestinians haven't been viewed with an equal measure of concern. It's worse than that. It appears that Palestinians were judged as less human than Israelis and were therefore not entitled to make demands to have their rights recognized and protected. Operating from this mindset, the U.S. has given the occupying regime of Israel carte blanche, while pressure and punishments have been reserved for the Palestinians. On occasion, policymakers have timidly raised the issue with some Israeli regime practices, but because they have taken no effective measures to change these behaviors, the Zionist regime has seen no reason to alter its course. As a result, the fake regime of Israel operates with impunity, while Palestinian actions have been scrutinized and condemned, and their protests have either been ignored or silenced as disruptive or counterproductive. Recent actions by the Biden administration sadly fit this pattern. In just the past few weeks, they have condemned the decision of the International Criminal Court, ICC, to begin prosecution of the regime of Israel for its war crimes in Gaza since 2014 and its illegal settlement expansion in the West Bank, criticized the UN Human Rights Council for its condemnation of Israeli regime abuses of Palestinian human rights, rejected tying U.S. aid to Israeli regime's human rights behaviors, declared opposition to Palestinian calls to boycott, divest, and sanction the Israeli regime for its violations of Palestinian rights. especially revealing, was one of the reasons given for U.S. opposition to Palestinians taking their complaints to international fora. The U.S. charged that such actions against Israel increased tensions and undercut efforts to advance a negotiated two-state solution. This appears to suggest that the Zionist regime's aggressive land confiscation, settlement construction, demolition of Palestinian homes, detention without charges or trial of hundreds of Palestinians, collective punishment of the entire population of Gaza, and the Zionist regime's mass killing sprees of Palestinians in 2014 and 2018 did not increase tensions or undercut efforts at peacemaking. But Palestinians seeking legal remedies against these Zionist actions is disruptive. In short, the Zionist regime of Israel can do whatever it wants with U.S. backing. But when Palestinians protest precisely because the U.S. will not do nothing to defend them, they are at fault. Regardless of the U.S. intent, what this says to the Palestinians is that their human rights don't matter and will always be subordinated to Israeli interests. Listen to this exchange at a recent State Department briefing. A reporter asked, "Considering your position on the Palestinians now, where should the Palestinians go to get accountability for what they claim to be a problem?" The State Department official responded, "Of course, the United States is always going to stand up for human rights. That is why you have heard us continue to endorse a two-state solution to this long-running conflict, because it protects Israel's identity as a Jewish and democratic state, but it will also give the Palestinians a viable state of their own and fulfill their legitimate aspirations for dignity and self-determination," unquote. Because the answer was non-responsive to the question asked, the reporter repeated 13 times, "Where do they go?" No further reply was given. The best this administration has so far offered the Palestinians was the reiteration of a vague commitment to a negotiated two-state solution. But this remains hollow as long as it fails to address the complete and abusive control of the Israeli regime exercises over Palestinians and their land, and the U.S. refuses to apply pressure to end these Zionist regime abuses. Even more telling was a policy address on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict delivered by a U.S. ambassador at a recent meeting of the U.N. Security Council. It was so Israeli regime-centric that any acknowledgement of Palestinian concerns were either accompanied by kibitz or framed in terms of Israeli regime's interest. For example, the ambassador expressed the hope that Israelis and Palestinians would both get COVID-19 vaccines, but sidestepped any mention of the Israeli regime's refusal to accept its responsibility to do this. He recognized the unsustainable disparity in economic development between Israelis and Palestinians, but weirdly attributed this to a structural issue that should be diagnosed and addressed, without acknowledging that the structural issue has a name: occupation.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Hezbollah had been vanquished. That's perhaps the most significant and upsetting question about the 2006 war.
Much has been said about the 2006 war, about its motives, the behind the scenes, and the circumstances around it, its planning and development, its details and objectives, as well as its outcome and the lessons learned from the war. Also, much speculation has been made about what led to the war. When considering the situation in Lebanon, in the occupying Zionist regime, in Palestine, and in the region, as well as the U.S. role in the war, one of the main issues that needs a close look is what would have happened if the resistance in Lebanon was defeated.
How did Hezbollah defeat Israel?
Part 4.
Speaking of a hypothetical defeat would not be possible without examining the history of Arab defeats. Just as one cannot hypothesize about Hezbollah's defeat without taking into account the nature and identity of the supposed winner. There are two other questions that have to be asked. One is, how did Israel overcome the Arabs? And the other is, how did Hezbollah defeat Israel? Only then can one hypothesize about the consequences of a Hezbollah defeat in the 2006 war. Actions have already come under scrutiny in numerous occasions, and many of them have been based on personal judgments. This has been due to the secrecy of Hezbollah and its military activities, leading to a shortage of information available to those interested in studying the military doctrine of the Islamic resistance. But the July war provided military experts, especially the Israelis and Americans, with the opportunity to get acquainted with Hezbollah's operational strategies, particularly considering that the war was on a larger scale and longer than other Arab-Israeli wars. The main question of the military experts was whether Hezbollah had a pyramidal form of command, which enabled it to have such an effective control on its forces and equipment on the battlefield. What we present to you here is not the official stance of the resistance movement. Rather, it is a summary of what senior American and Israeli officers have said in their studies that recognizes a four-layered hierarchy of military command within Hezbollah. Operation Command Room, where Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah and most senior officers meet. This room is directly in contact with the second layer of the pyramid of command. The second layer is the Central Operations Room, run by operations officers equipped with the most advanced command, control, and guidance, communications, and computer facilities, generally known as the C4ISR. These are needed to lead battles. The operations room also features military intelligence and interception units that are tasked with tracking and tracing enemy moves. Such units are in local operations rooms, consisted of field officers who guide the battles directly and at close range. This room is in direct contact with the battle itself and issues the needed orders to infantry, anti-armor, and missile units, including those in charge of anti-destroyer missiles and other weapons. This is the hierarchy of military command in the form of a pyramid that begins with the top commander and goes all the way down to the foot soldiers on the battlefield. Hezbollah's commander of operations can control all parts of the frontline activities and therefore can even control the firing of a single missile. This makes its decisions for the battlefield balanced while giving units involved in the conflict special authorization to adopt appropriate tactical moves on the battlefield. Such an approach to commanding a battle is by no means a characteristic of guerrilla groups. Rather, Hezbollah presented a new method in the non-civilian battles doctrine in the July 2006 war. The climax of what we call pyramidal in the command and control hierarchy in the Islamic resistance came to light with the targeting of the Hanat destroyer. The July 2006 war, the number of Israeli naval forces reached 5,500 Marines. Moreover, 6,600 reservists on standby for emergencies were also called in for the battle. Israeli naval fleet, comprising of three Sa'ar 5-class destroyers, are distributed in the naval bases at Haifa, Atlit, Ashdod, and Eilat. There are also two other Sa'ar 4 destroyers and eight Sa'ar 4.5 vessels, as well as 89 patrol boats of different classes. From the very beginning, the Israeli Navy was tasked with encircling Lebanon, and two of its units attacked Lebanese shoreline. One of these two units was the Sa'ar 5-class Hanat destroyer.
The technical features of the destroyer make it one of the best in service around the world. It has a stealth body form, which means all its structures and facilities are designed with obtuse angles. Aside from this feature, which is now common in the world, what was uncommon, rare, and exclusive to this destroyer was that it could hide its thermal trace through cooling its own body. The vessel's engine are covered by a two-story structure where constant flow of water cools exhaust gas from the engines little by little to hide their thermal trace. Israel knew that some Arab countries are aware of its highly advanced electronic technology and its ability to scatter signals that misled missiles fired at its destroyers, and that they had turned to thermal missiles. Hanat and its two peers are the only existing destroyers in the world that leave no thermal trace of themselves.
On the second day of the war in the morning, Hanat, along with a small fleet of four destroyers, left for the battle. They were accompanied by three patrol boats. Some of them were dispatched from the port of Haifa and others from Ashdod. Seven ships lined up in a stretch of water between 16 miles off Lebanese waters and Lebanon's Nakura City in the north.
The destroyer is armed with a full set of weaponry, including American 120-kilometer range Gabriel and Barak missiles. Each of its defensive packets consists of 32 missiles. It also has a 76-millimeter automatic cannon along with a fast-firing cannon. Even more importantly, it enjoys highly sophisticated electronic warfare equipment. The vessel is also armed with a stealth jamming system that creates false frequencies around the real target to mislead incoming missiles. Hezbollah's top command ordered an attack on the enemy where it least expected, that is on the sea, and it was done by a weapon that caused Israelis the first surprise of the battle, as they were earlier promised by the resistance movement's Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. Hezbollah had secretly trained an anti-destroyer missile unit capable of operating in the most difficult and sophisticated battlefield conditions. All that was done out of the range of Israel's espionage apparatus.
The Islamic Resistance Command issued an order to the anti-destroyer units in the evening of the second day of the July War. The units were ordered to give an immediate and crushing response to the Israeli Navy after it violated the territorial waters off Lebanon's capital Beirut and attacked the southern Zahia region of the city. According to Israeli intelligence sources, the system, exclusively developed for transport and operation of C-802 missiles, was deployed on a height in southern Beirut overlooking the sea. Two groups were in charge of launching the missile. The first was tasked with examining the situation at sea to recognize the target and review the radar information, and the second was the launching squad who used the gathered data to activate the missile's electronic devices to guide them to their targets. They were also tasked with preparing the launch pad for the zero hour. Resistance Movement's operation room issued the order of attack at 0800 p.m. local time while Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah was delivering a live TV address broadcast from Al-Manar channel. A brilliant light, coupled with a thundering noise, filled the air as the two missiles were fired.
On your logic, and we rely on our power to take risks. Surely, we have the assistance and support of God. We have never challenged you, except by reliance on God's assistance and our nation and hearts and children. Today, we renew our pledge that victory is near at hand with the help of God.
One of Nasrallah's deputies rushed toward him to tell him that the mission had been accomplished. Nasrallah suddenly changed the subject to the targeting of the Israeli destroyer and the surprises the battle had for the enemy. That was a turning point in the war.
The surprises I had promised will happen from now on. Now look at the waters off Beirut and the Israeli destroyer, which targeted our infrastructure and our people's homes, and see how it is burning in flames.
انظروا إليها تحتوي.
Everything happened when Israel's Chief of General Staff, Dan Halutz, was at a press conference briefing reporters on the accomplishments of the first airstrike.
What made the achievement even more fascinating was that the Israeli destroyer was attacked during Nasrallah's media address when people had their attention focused on Hezbollah. Therefore, it became a memorable blow to Israel thanks to how the attack was conducted.
جالب توجه است که اسرائیلی‌ها برای توجیه
It is remarkable how Israelis resorted to humiliating language to justify the destroyer's weaknesses. For example, they said the destroyer's electronic warfare systems were not active. This is the stupidest thing a military force can say after it has waged an all-out war against Lebanon and Hezbollah. Imagine they have dispatched a destroyer and it is firing at Lebanese targets and leading the naval offensive, but its electronic warfare systems are inactive. In fact, the humiliation was so huge for the Israelis that forced them to use such justifications. I don't think anybody familiar with the matter has accepted their justification for the first destroyer. Some in the uninformed Israeli public may have accepted it, but if we accept the justification for the attack on the first Israeli vessel, what should we think of the attack on the second? What about the second and the third attacks? Three vessels, two Tsar-class destroyers, and a smaller one were targeted. It is interesting that Al Jazeera TV channel showed live pictures of the third destroyer when it was hit.
The missiles closed in on Haniyeh freely and without any problem. One of the missiles missed the destroyer, but the second hit the 85-meter-long target at its rear part, where a military helicopter had been landing. The point of impact was on the vessel, and the missile exploded over its deck rather than inside the destroyer's body. The explosion triggered a large fire, with the nearby helicopter fuel tanks nourishing the flames. Chaos reigned among the destroyer's 80-member crew. Even after several minutes, they had not realized that the explosion was caused by an enemy missile impact. Two hours after the fire broke out, they realized that four soldiers, including two intelligence officers and two Air Force troops, had been killed. The damage to the vessel was estimated at $40 million, one-fourth of its total value, and forced it out of service for more than a year.
Some media and military resources have revealed that the casualties were 24 people rather than four. The news has come out over the past month. In fact, the four were torn to pieces by the explosion. Four are missing and others have suffered critical injuries. Meanwhile, the Israeli Navy was hit with mayhem for 20 hours after the attack, despite Israel's claim that the force was fully organized and in a better condition than before. There's also no news of the Haniyeh's return to the Navy in the Jane's Fighting Ships website.
It was one of those incidents that the Zionist enemy never imagined to happen. They deemed it likely that their tanks would be hit or that they lose their infantry units. or even that a Hezbollah missile would target the occupied territories. But they never imagined that their ultra-modern destroyer would be hit at sea, where they felt no military threat. It is God's will that the destroyer is targeted, just as Sayyid Hassan is delivering his TV address, so that he says at the end that people can go to Beirut's coastlines and see the destroyer burning in flames. The incident was a shock not only to the Israelis, but also to the world. You know that major military powers such as the U.S. are marine-based. Their air force is marine-based, and even their land units are stationed on vessels.
The next day, the Israeli Air Force launched a number of attacks on all the Lebanese Army's radar bases. Israelis believed that Lebanon's army radars had contributed to the targeting of the destroyer. They unleashed a 30-minute non-stop attack on the Ozai port and some hills overlooking the sea. The Israeli Navy failed to tow Hanid away from Lebanese waters in 3 days, and they had to ask for help from the U.S. Navy to transfer it to the port of Ashdod in the south of the Palestinian-occupied territories. The destroyer was towed to Ashdod because the Israeli Navy's main base at Haifa was within the range of the resistance movement's missiles, so the Israelis fully evacuated the port.
The 33-day war almost led to the elimination of what we formerly knew as the Israeli Navy. When you refer to the data available on Israel, including satellite images, you see no sign of Israeli vessels, neither in Haifa, which is the Israeli Navy's main hub, nor in Tel Aviv and their entire Israeli marine borders. You see no Israeli Navy vessels, neither close to the Lebanese borders, nor in the vicinity of Palestine. You will find no trace ever of the two-star class destroyers and the Israeli frigate that accompanied them.
Hezbollah's military command created a unique and advanced anti-naval force with the help of land-to-sea missiles. Hezbollah used the capability 3 times during the war, and they surprised commanders of the Israeli fleet, who closely pursued the battle every single time.
The key question is how such a destroyer can be targeted by a guerrilla group. The main issue is the highly confidential technology used by the units that prepared for the attack and fired the missile. As technologically speaking, launching a missile toward such a target is no easy task. The Sa'ar 5 incident shattered the dreams of many world countries that looked up at a vessel as the apex of the technology used in their own Sa'ar 2, 3.5, 4, and 4.5 destroyers. How Hezbollah forces managed to do that, while they are not even a naval force or an organized coastal guard? They are rather a group of ordinary people with a will to fight, who were secretly trained and secretly advanced towards the enemy, dealt a blow and withdrew, without ever being identified by the enemy. That was realized despite the enemy being equipped with satellites and unmanned drones, which provided it with the entire picture of the situation during the conflict. These brave people managed to beat the enemy despite the fact that targeting of the destroyer was no easy task.
شغلة كبيرة كثير كانت تتفاخر إسرائيل وهلق إسرائيل موصية على ثنتين منها لحد هلق ما إجوا.
Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah ended his speech and Beirut was filled with joy as people took to the streets to watch the burning destroyer at sea.
في أي حرب مقبلة تريدون شنها على لبنان.
In every war that you may be going to wage against Lebanon in the future, if you besiege our ports, the entire fleet of your military, civilian and trade vessels heading toward Palestinian ports in the Mediterranean will come under fire by the Islamic resistance.
In the limelight.
Decades of segregation and economic inequality in the U.S. shoehorned many people of color, especially Black Americans, into living in neighborhoods that are more vulnerable to climate change, says Jessica Corbett, writer, in an article titled, Study Finds U.S. Redlined Areas Face Greater Flood Risk from Climate Crisis. Stay tuned for more.